06, Whitefish Enterprises LLC versus Dan, I hope this pronounced this right, Liegeld et al. As all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I should just caution everyone, the matter or this oral argument is being recorded and will be available to be listened to tomorrow online. However, our court rules prohibit any party or guest or attorney or anyone who's just, you know, watching to record it for themselves, either video or an audio fashion. So please keep that in mind. Counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, you may begin. And just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jennifer Morrow on behalf of the appellants here today. Your Honors, in this case, the primary error here that we seek to reverse in the district court's order was the district court's failure to construe the declaration at issue here in favor of unrestricted use of property. Restrictive covenants, such as those contained in the declaration, must be construed strictly in favor of unrestricted use and against.
If I could just stop you right there. I mean, your statement that the declaration should be construed for unrestrained use. My first question to you is this declaration, in your opinion, is it unambiguous?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so if it's unambiguous, a declaration is a contract. And so we apply the rules of contract interpretation. And so the declaration has a number of different statements of what it allows and what it prohibits. And it prohibits any type of commercial or business use on the properties. And if that seems to be pretty clear, and if it's prohibiting those, then why aren't the dredging activities or the houseboating activities, why aren't those in violation of that declaration?
Your Honor is correct that the declaration is construed as a contract and contract principles apply. However, given that this is a declaration involving restrictive covenants on the use of real property, those provisions contained in the declaration should be construed strictly against limitations of use. So to Your Honor's question,
even taking that into account, the language of those restrictive covenants are pretty clear in terms of prohibiting commercial and business activity. So why isn't the activities of dredging and houseboating, why aren't those in violation of the
I think the answer lies in construction of what constitutes a commercial activity under the declaration. And it is my position here that under the law, restrictive covenants should be construed strictly. So as that a commercial activity is then also construed strictly in favor of unrestricted use of the property and construed against limitations of the use of property. So for example, I raised an example in my reply brief that if a homeowner, for example, on this property happens to use their car for Uber and they store their vehicle on their property. Under the district court's order here, simply because a vehicle or equipment is used for a commercial purpose, the district court here ruled that that is a commercial activity prohibited by the declaration. And here in this
How is that analogy applicable here? Because you don't have a restrictive covenant in your example. And I understand one of your other arguments to be that the dredging and the houseboats were not making a profit, but I don't see any requirement in the declaration that those restrictive covenants are limited to a profit-making business. So I'm kind of struggling with the arguments that you're making on behalf of that the declaration doesn't control here.
I believe the declaration does control here, but I understand your Honor's question here is, I believe a useful way to look at this is that if a complaint of activity or complaint of use, is it consistent with single family residential use? And here, for example, the activity that's being complained of here is storage of dredging equipment on this property or the houseboats that have been docking off the docks of the property. And if you look at the declaration, that does not, the complaint of activity here is not prohibited. Is the question then becomes is storage of dredging equipment on property, is that a commercial activity? And if you construe the covenants strictly, it is not commercial activity. It is simply storage of dredging equipment or using a boat ramp to launch dredging equipment, which the declaration does contemplate in its provisions that are granting an easement over all of the properties. So dredging.
So under your theory, then, let's say I own a car dealership and I've, you know, got 1,000 cars. And under your argument, could I store 50 cars on my property?
Are you talking about under terms of this declaration or
yes,
in general?
Absolutely.
Well, under the term of the declaration, any storage of vehicles need to be screened properly or stored in buildings. So looking at those provisions in themselves, if there's ability to store, I suppose, that many cars for a long period of time, potentially it could be permissible under the declaration. And again, Your Honors, this goes back to construction of these terms strictly and against limitations of use, because the interests here involve matters of real property. But of course, here we're not talking about storage of 50 cars for a dealership on this property. We're talking of storage of personally owned dredging equipment that incidentally is also, other equipment is also stored at my client's residential property located in a different.
How big is the dredging equipment? I mean, is it like a crane?
It's not a crane. I believe there's a photo of it in the record before Your Honors. I don't have a site in front of me. I apologize for that. But it's a floating hoe, I believe is what it's called. And it's hidden behind trees, shielding it from the lake. And you can see a picture of it there.
Is the dredging equipment used on the lake for dredging activities?
It can be, yes, which is why there was...
No, that wasn't my question. The question is it being used for dredging activity?
Currently, no, but it has in the past.
Okay. So that dredging activity, how is that not commercial activity?
Well, Your Honor, that's an interesting, it's an interesting dynamic here because dredging can only occur on the lake and there has to be a way to launch that dredging equipment into the lake. So the fact
I understand that. I understand how it's used and why it's used. That seems to be commercial activity, the same as the houseboat where you've got the docks operate on the dock. They're stored there in the winter, as I understand the dredging activity. I'm just struggling. I'm not hearing a good argument as to why those are not commercial activities that are strictly prohibited by the declaration. I understand your argument in terms of how you construe them, but parties can enter into a contract and they can make whatever provisions they want in a declaration as to what is done or not done. You mentioned that it says this is for single home activities, but my understanding from the record is on lots 6, 7, and 8, there's not a home on any of those lots, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I will preface my response by saying you did cut out a little bit, but I believe I understand the scope of your question.
Okay, sorry about that.
No, that's obviously, this is not your fault. So to answer your question, Your Honors, here is with the dredging equipment here, I can't dispute and I won't dispute that when dredging has occurred, that is a commercial activity. However, if you look at the terms of the declaration, it specifically contemplates dredging occurring at this property on the lake that Driftwood is at, and also for property owners to grant access to the lake for dredging equipment here. So if the property owners hired a third party entity to come do dredging, the dredging equipment would come through their property to access the lake. Here we just simply happen to have an owner who has the skills and equipment to also dredge the lake. And as for the houseboats, my response to that would be is if the issue here that's raised in this case did not seem to originate from potentially my clients receiving money in exchange for these houseboats mooring at the docks. The complaint appears to be stemming from the houseboats mooring at the docks, their very existence at the docks. However, that is no different than parties inviting guests to stay at their docks for a period of time.
The difference there is if you have guests that are there, you know, that's a different issue than if you are running some type of business or commercial activity such as having docks there for houseboats to come in permanently. That's a lot different than if you have a homeowner or cabin owner that is bringing their dock or having guests bring boats or jet skis or whatever. But I want to change gears slightly, because one of the other arguments you make, which I found rather interesting, is that you argue that they don't even have standing to bring this claim in the first place. And it seems that under Chapter 515B, that allows enforcement of a declaration by parties and those that person who is adversely affected by a violation of the declaration can bring a claim for relief. And the Humphrey case talks about that as well. So I'm curious as to why don't they have standing? It almost seems like a fairly straightforward issue. Moreover, the restrictive covenant itself gave enforcement rights to any owner of the benefited parcel. So, is that an issue that you are going to continue to pursue, or is that one we don't even really have to consider anymore?
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree with your assessment of the declaration. So it is an issue that I continue to pursue for lack of standing here. In the declaration, the provision that's at issue for enforcement of the declaration and its covenants is in Article 4.4. And the way the article is written in the passive voice, it does not indicate who has the ability to bring an enforcement action, instead referring to Chapter 515B, that any enforcement action should be brought subject to 515B and in accordance with its statute. And as Your Honor indicated, the 515B .4-116, that does allow persons other than an association, which does not exist here, allows persons to bring an enforcement action if they had been adversely affected. And looking at the record before the court here, there has been no allegation rising to the level of an adverse effect or to an injury in fact, which is a doctrine of standing, here to allow respondent to bring this action. And that is the basis of the standing argument here.
Well, so the quiet enjoyment by a cabin owner is not a right that they can pursue. That seems a little odd and contrary to case law, but it seems like the restrictive covenant does give that right to owner. So I guess my question is, if we were to follow the logic of your argument, it seems that nobody would have any right to bring enforcement of the declaration. Is that correct?
Again, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with you that the statute does allow parties who are adversely affected. And if you look at the declaration under a different section, it's Article 3.1.10, that does address nuisances here. And this is not a nuisance action. No allegation or insinuation whatsoever has been made regarding nuisance. This would be my position that if you look at the provisions of that article, it specifically describes various types of nuisances, none of which or none of the allegations here rise to the level of nuisance set forth in the declaration. So if we construe the declaration as a contract and for the party's intent, the declarant's intent here, there was no intent for various property owners to essentially selectively police or enforce this declaration. And I think part of the issue here, Your Honor, that again raises to the standing question, is if the complaint of activity here, for example, such as with the houseboats having guests there and perhaps a party-like atmosphere at some times or campfires being blowing, that's no different than any other cabin owner on the property, which respondent acknowledged in the summary judgment briefing here. The complaint.
I think Article 4.4 that you're referencing, that just talks about the fact that any owner can bring an action at law. In other words, they can go to court to enforce any of the provisions of the declaration. 4.3 talks about how the benefits shall inure to the benefit of the owners of the property.
4.3 does talk about the covenants running with the property. I would contend that's similar to a restrictive covenant contained in a deed, that it continues on. It doesn't cease at the transfer of property. But 4.4 is the enforcement provision that does not specify who can bring it, instead deferring to the provisions of 515B, which would require some sort of an adverse effect akin to an injury in fact, under as set forth in standing law.
So if the declaration is a contract, here the respondent then was subject to the terms of the contract, didn't it also have the right to accept, to expect the benefits of that contract, that being the limitations to residential use only? And wouldn't that be an injury, in fact, that would support standing, Ms. Merle?
Your Honor, it's my position that under the declaration and the way it is written and deferring to 515B, that any sort of strict enforcement, such as what Your Honor suggests, that ability to enforce lies with an association, which the declaration does contemplate. However, one has not yet been formed. That is what the provisions of 515B provide, absent an adverse effect or some sort of other injury in fact. And my time being almost up, Your Honors, I would ask that this court reverse the district court and enter judgment for appellants. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I'm not here for counsel for the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Mark Thiroff, and I represent the respondent in this matter. I'd like to begin this morning with the declaration itself briefly, because there's been, I think, some confusion in the briefing regarding just exactly what it allows on the driftwood lots. Appellants have made various arguments about what may or may not constitute a business or conducting business. But the court doesn't really need to reach that issue at all, because Article 3.1.1 imposes a bright line prohibition that we believe is dispositive of the merits issue in this case. 3.1.1 says the use of lots shall be limited to single family private residential dwellings and for no other purpose, period. It also says no business activities. And Article 3.1.4 has some language regarding having an office or a business meeting in a structure. But when it comes to a lot, 3.1.1 says single family dwelling and nothing else. Now, there could be questions about if you have a single family dwelling, are you allowed to do some other things that you might not be allowed to do without the single family dwelling? We don't have to answer that question here today because we don't have that issue before us or those facts. But what we know is that these three lots have no single family dwelling on them. The district court found that appellants were violating 3.1.1 in a number of ways, including renting out the docks, allowing the lots to be used for storage purposes relating to the renting of the docks, and that's the sheds that each of the docks has, allowing winter storage of the houseboats on the lots as part of this rental of the docks, storing the dredging equipment that's used in appellant's business on lot 8, using a boat ramp on lot 8 for the dredging equipment and the houseboats, and allowing lot 7 to be used as a parking area for the houseboat folks and their guests and so forth. And there were no genuine issues of material fact as to any of these violations. And significantly, all of them were based on deposition testimony of Dan Liegeld. Respondent relied solely on Mr. Liegeld's deposition testimony for all of those violations. Mr. Liegeld testified that the houseboat owners pay property taxes on and maintain the lots in exchange for the right to moor their houseboats at the docks. He testified that the houseboat owners erected and maintained storage sheds on the lots. He testified that the owners of three of the houseboats store their boats on the lots in the off season. He testified that the dredging equipment he stores on the lots is used in his dredging business. He testified that the parking area for the houseboats is located on lot 7. And he testified that the boat ramp is used for putting in and taking out both the houseboats and the dredging equipment. Judge Reyes, to your question about the barge and the dredging activities, page 11 of our brief has a photograph of the barge. It's a photograph taken towards the bow, so the narrow end of the boat. You don't get a full sense of its length, but it's a barge, and Mr. Liegel testified that it has a backhoe affixed to the top of it. The wheels aren't on there anymore, and it's attached to the top of the barge so that the barge can float the backhoe around and it can do its dredging work. Mr. Liegel also testified regarding your question about the commercial activities. I believe he's testified he's done three jobs elsewhere on the Whitefish chain of lakes using the equipment that he owns for his business, some of which is stored here and some of which is stored at his residence. On the standing issue, I want to be clear that we believe respondents had standing to bring this action based on general common law standing principles that we've cited at length in our brief. But we also believe, even if this were controlled by Chapter 515B, that respondents have standing under 515B.4-116 as a party adversely affected by what's being alleged here. And the adverse effect can be found in lots of different places, but I would point the court firstly to Article 4.3 of the declaration, which we've talked about already this morning, which says that the covenants in this declaration shall inure to the benefit of the owners of the property, meaning the lots. That benefit that inures to them is the benefit of the covenants, the benefit of knowing that when you buy a lot in this plat, in this development, you will benefit from knowing that your neighbor's properties aren't going to be used in ways that are prohibited by the covenants in the declaration. So by definition, if there's a violation of one of the covenants, the owners of the other lots are adversely affected by that, by virtue of the language in Article 4.3. Beyond that, the district court heard testimony regarding the adverse effects on respondent, and specifically testimony that that appellants were renting out these five houseboat slips on a single lot immediately next to their lot. So that all five houseboat slips are on lot 7. My clients own lot 6. And that throughout the boating season, that single lot was used by the houseboat owners and their extended families and friends as a vacation destination. So in other words, that single lot that was intended for one single family dwelling was experiencing at least 5 times the permitted amount of density in terms of residential use. There were quite a few references in appellant's brief, and I believe one here this morning, to this phrase, using the property as any cabin owner would. And that comes from something that we said in the district court, describing how each of the 5 houseboat owners, the point we're trying to convey is that if you imagine how a cabin owner uses a property, that's how each of these houseboat owners is operating. So it's not to say that they're allowed to do anything that you would be able to do if there were a single family dwelling on that property. The point is, when you think about the level of activity, the types of activities, bonfires, you know, whatever you might do at your cabin, the point that was being made is that there's 5 times that amount of activity going on lot 7, where there are 5 of these slips, each with electrical hookups, water hookups, you know, the whole 9 yards.
So Mr. Thurop, I just wanna make sure we're clear, because it's not uncommon for a cabin owner to have a dock and have 1, 2, 3 boats, jet skis, a number of pontoons, a number of different things. Because, I mean, I wanna make sure you're not stating a position that might be too broad and inadvertently prohibit a cabin owner from being able to have those. Are you just stating that because these are houseboats and people are, they've got the electrical hookups, they've got the water hookups, that they're using it in essence as a residence, but rather than on the lot itself per se, but they're using the dock that's extending from lot 7 as essentially a residence?
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. I do want to clarify. I don't want to misstate our argument here. Going back to the declaration, as I said initially, what's the use that is permitted of each of these lots is a single family residential dwelling. And we fully acknowledge and accept that in connection with a single family residential dwelling, there are other accessory uses that would no doubt be permitted, such as having a dock, exercising your riparian rights, having your friends across the lake, boat over and moor at your dock and so forth. What we're saying is that we don't have that use here at all. We don't have a single family residential dwelling. So there's no question before the court as to what would the scope of the accessory permitted accessory uses be under this declaration, because what we have is an undeveloped vacant piece of land where the owner is not engaged in single family residential dwelling use. The owner is engaged in leasing out mooring space to these five houseboat owners, which is not permitted under the declaration. So it's not having docks per se, or using docks per se, or boating per se, or anything like that. It's how these specific lots are being used. I hope that answers your question.
It does, thank you.
So getting beyond the issue of standing, assuming we agree that there was standing to bring this action, Mr. Theroff, appellant then claims, well, even if there's standing, it's moot because we amended the declaration that allows this activity to occur. Do you agree that the question of mootness depends on whether or not the amendment to this declaration was effective?
No, I don't, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, I think it is crucially important to underscore that even if this amendment were drafted in a manner to have accomplished what appellants claim it accomplished, and even if it were duly adopted and enacted and effective, on its face, it addresses only the boat ramp. It does not say a word in there about the houseboats, about the storage of the houseboats, about the parking area on lot 7. It doesn't say anything about that at all. It doesn't amend Article 3.1.1's prohibition on any use other than a single family residential lot. So that's the first point. Let's imagine for sake of argument that this amendment was effective. The declaration still prohibits what appellants have been doing in terms of leasing out these docks and allowing the related storage activities and so forth. So that's point one. Point two, which I alluded to a bit, is that if we read the Third Amendment carefully, we see that all it does is authorize the owner of lots 7, 8, and 9 to do two things. One is to apply for a rezoning or a reclassification of these lots from shoreland residential to water-oriented commercial. File an application with the county, that's authorized. I'm not sure that that was prohibited before that, but it makes it expressly allowed. And it allows the owner of lot 7 and 8 to apply for a conditional use permit to have the boat ramp. Again, I'm not sure the owner was prohibited from doing that beforehand, but it makes that clear now. Neither one of those things changes Article 3.1.1's use prohibitions, leaves it entirely unaffected. So again, if, you know, putting aside the question of how many people you needed to support this, whether you needed unanimity and so forth, even if it were validly enacted, on its face, it accomplishes nothing of relevance to this case.
Mr. Theroff, along the same lines, can you address the issue of appellants argue that the it did not change it from strictly residential, and that you could still have multiple uses for the property?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe, are you referring to arguments over the unanimity requirement?
Well, getting beyond, related to the unanimity, but with respect to the definitions of residential use versus non-residential use.
I'm not understanding the question. Could you rephrase it?
Yeah, I'm not stating it very articulately, but I think there's a dispute over what whether the section defining what residential use covers. In other words, is it just limited to primary and secondary housing of some kind, or could you have mixed residential along with non-residential activities, commercial and business activities, and the change in it from residential use only to non-residential or even mixed?
I understand. Thank you, Your Honor. Again, I think this goes back to Article 3.1.1. We have a clause there that addresses the permitted uses of these lots. And it says there's one permitted use of the lot, and that's a single family residential dwelling. And that's it. Even says, and no other purpose. So I really don't think that there's any debate as to what the permitted uses of these lots. Now, as I alluded to, I see I'm out of time. If I could just quickly answer the question. You could have a case later down the road where someone is taking issue with a lot owner's commercial activities on a lot where it has a single family residential dwelling. And, that is an issue that I'm not 100% sure how that comes out and where you draw that line, but that those facts aren't before us and that issue isn't before us. So I'd respectfully suggest that that's an issue that we could leave for another day.
Thank you, Mr. Thiroff. Ms. Morrow, you'll have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would like to use this time here to address the court's questions on the briefing issue regarding the mootness issue. Regarding the Third Amendment, if you look at its terms, it does amend Article 3.1.1 to add a use. So going back to the issue of whether or not it was changed from a residential permission to non-residential, it did not. By its own terms, it added a provision to allow these three lots to be rezoned to waterfront commercial and also to be issued a conditional use permit. And the phrasing likely was due to the declaration, which does contain an article that anything that requires a county's written consent needs to be obtained here. And the Third Amendment did moot this dispute. If you look at the record before the court, and particularly the emails exchanged between counsel at the time of the action was commenced, the issue was mutually understood to be the effectiveness of the Third Amendment. And more specifically, did it require unanimous consent? And because it did not change the use from residential to non-residential, unanimous consent was not required, and the requisite two-thirds approval was obtained here. And given that the Third Amendment also allowed the rezoning to waterfront commercial,
Ms. Monroe, if I could just stop you on the second one, and I was trying to articulate your position. Unfortunately, I did not do it very well. You did far better than I did. But it seems that that same section you're referring to defines residential use as, quote, use as a dwelling, whether primary, secondary, or seasonal, and does not include other types of activities. So that definition of residential use does appear to limit it to use of a dwelling and does not appear to include mixed uses. So it does seem that your attempt to amend Article 3.1.1 of the Declaration would fall under the statute, which means that would require a unanimous decision by all the owners.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that in the sense that if you look at the statute, it requires unanimous consent when the designated use is changed from one to the other, from residential to non-residential or vice versa. And looking at the language of the Third Amendment, it expressly states that it is adding a provision. So it is not changing the 3.1.
Well, how you phrase it doesn't change how it actually affects it, because the original 3.1.1, and you didn't dispute that it's unambiguous, the plain and clear language of it says, quote, the use of all lots shall be limited to single family private residential dwellings and for no other purpose. So if your amendment, the purported amendment, would have to change that use. It's extremely limited. It's only for single use dwellings and no other purpose, no other business. And 3.1.4 and even 3.1 touches on that as well. But 3.1 on one alone seems to stand for the proposition. This is only for single family dwellings, not for any other purpose, and no other business can be conducted. So if you're going to add a use, that seems to change it from both the statutory language and the clear language under the declaration itself.
Your Honor, if you look at the language of the statute in question here and the definitions in 515B of residential and non-residential, first of all, the Third Amendment does not prohibit residential use. It is still permitted under the waterfront commercial rezoning. A single family residence is still a permitted use under that zoning. And if you look at the definitions in the statute of 515B.1-103, residential is defined as Your Honor described it. However, interestingly enough, residential is not defined to exclude other kinds of use. To the contrary, non-residential is defined to prohibit any residential use. So we have one where non-residential use is defined to prohibit any other residential type of use, so it's purely non-residential, but residential use is not defined to be purely residential. And that is a distinction here that is significant in terms of whether unanimous consent is required here. It's the change from one entirely to the other versus simply adding another type of use here. And I also just wanted to close quickly regarding issues that were raised in respondents' argument of exchange of money to more at the docks. If I may finish my argument here is, if the issue is whether or not whether my clients receive money to exchange for mooring at the docks here, the resulting injunction was far too broad and the relief was far too broad, and that it prohibited the allowing of third party use rather than just prohibiting the business aspect of that. And with that, I'll conclude and ask that Your Honors reverse the district court and enter judgment for appellants. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The matter was well briefed and argued. We will issue our opinion in 90 days. That being our last Zoom oral argument, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.